This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. For the love of science, it's not quite Friday, but joining us this morning is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday, who's in town for a number of appearances this weekend.
Hawaii is a rich source of information, a kind of living laboratory for scientists of all stripes, so we're going to invite listeners to call in with any kind of science-related questions you might have for Ira Flatow. The number on Oahu is 941-3689. The number from Neighbor Islands, 1-877-941-3689. Ira, welcome.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So you haven't been here for a while. I understand you first came here for a family vacation.
That's right. I came about 10 years ago, and it was my first taste of Hawaii. I was really impressed. It lived up to everything I thought it would be. I was certainly startled by all the chickens I saw. Everybody is. But I saw we were on a Zodiac taking a trip with the kids, and it was the first time we'd have dolphins following us. I'd never, you know, always seen this on television. I've been a science reporter. I've been to the South Pole and Antarctica, but I've never seen dolphins.
Yeah.
It was great. And then I remember going to lunch. We would stop at lunch and do some snorkeling, and we stopped for snorkeling, and I got my snorkel gear on, and I took a little dive down about 20 feet, and I saw all the coral was dead. And I, yeah, you know, and I'm saying, global warming has hit, you know, Hawaii. And it was really upsetting to see that.
Well, it is, and we've certainly seen ample evidence of the human impact.
Right, climate changes everywhere.
Well, you know, there are any number of human impacts observable in Hawaii on the environment. Few of them good, right? We've got more endangered species than any other place.
Not something to, you know, be on the top of the list. You don't want to be the top of the list of more endangered species, but it's everywhere you go. There's no denying what you can see or feel, or in terms of the weather, or in terms of endangered species, in terms of the spread of disease by insects. You see plants migrating. That's really an interesting thing to see plants moving. For example, in New England, where I come from, mm-hmm. maple syrup trees are going north.
Really?
Because they like the cold weather, you know? And we were talking about the lobster catch was record lobster. Its price of lobster was down around Maine because the fish or the stuff the lobster eat was in abundance, but now the water's gotten so warm that competitors have moved up to eat that fish, eat the kind of stuff the lobsters were having, so.
Well, adaptation.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's adaptation.
At the same time, you know, do you see a growth of science denial?
It depends on where you look. Something I've discovered over the last few years is there's a myth about science, and the myth is that people don't like science. People love science, and our audience shows the growth in our audience. We're more popular than we've ever been on Science Friday. I mean, we have an audience of 2 million people between our radio show and our podcast. And mm-hmm. Now we do educational materials, and now we do another podcast called Undiscovered. And having grown up in the 60s and having gone to school in Washington and during the Watergate era, I believe in follow the money. Remember when Deep Throat said, follow the money?
Can't go wrong.
If you look where the big money is being spent in communications and entertainment, it is being spent on science-related projects. Look, for example, The Big Bang Theory, the TV show, number one show on television. 2014, you had two science biopics vying for the best movie. When did that ever happen before?
Yeah.
So the big money, which is spending hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, knows that people like science, and that is where to reach them. That is where they're putting the money. So
it is interesting too, though. I know with organizations like NOAA, you know, where the shift in money has gone from, let's say, the oceans to weather.
Yes, because weather, you know, is everything. It's interesting. I used to, because I've been doing this for a while, and I've been following where the money in Washington gets spent. And I used to say, well, if there was ever, you know, an earthquake in Washington, they would fund, you know, earthquake. And there was an earthquake in Washington. That gets a little more fun. If there was ever hurricanes that came through, they'd fund that. And the hurricanes came through. It really depends on science impacts people personally. And if you want, you can argue blue in the face about, do you believe in global warming or climate change? If people don't want to believe that, they're not going to believe it. They're going to find something else to pick out of it until it hits them personally, either in their pocketbook or some or a family member or something like that. And then it's amazing how quickly people's views change about science. And it's true of medicine, everything else about science.
It's interesting because I remember covering the king tides that we had last year, which is really high tides. And I happened to snap a picture of how the seawater had come up out of the storm drains,
right.
And there was water over the sidewalk, and there were fish on the sidewalk. And I snapped a picture for the web, and it's amazing how much play that one shot got.
You know, that's the same thing that that's going on in Florida. Every full moon or when there's a high tide, southern Florida is literally underwater. And, you know, streets that didn't used to get flooded are now regularly flooded. And people down there know that that's, you know, that's due to climate change and the rising sea level. So you can't deny what your eyes can see. Yeah.
But it's amazing that that information doesn't get transmitted that far past those who are immediately affected, right?
Well, I think we're seeing a change. I think especially with climate change, I like to talk about a paradigm shift. I think paradigm shifts are generational.
Mm-hmm.
They take 20 years or so for something to change. And I think the young people, the teenagers now, who we're seeing becoming very active, they're now, you know, they're now concentrated on gun violence. When they discover that there's going to be the earth that their parents knew is not going to exist unless they grow up, they're going to suddenly look at big issues, other big issues also, and start getting more active along those ways too.
What are you seeing as far as, like, science in the classroom?
I know from our efforts of science in the classroom, teachers are very interested. But the problem with teachers is there are not enough of them trained as science teachers. A teacher might graduate with a teaching degree, and let's say she may be assigned to be a social studies teacher. And then she is now said, okay, you're now going to teach science. So it's very hard for her to make that transition. We're beginning to offer teaching materials on our website, sciencefriday.com. We have relationships with hundreds of thousands of teachers, and we actually create. Sometimes we do it on Facebook Live. You need to do a demonstration. Watch us do it.
By that model that you describe of teaching, a teacher is lucky to stay one book ahead of the students, right?
Yes, and we have found very motivated teachers, and teachers are very eager to do what they can if we help them, and that's what we try to do is help them.
We've got a couple of calls on the line. Here's a caller with a question related to what you were discussing earlier about coral reefs. Stephen?
Yes.
Calling from Maui. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. So I've been thinking a lot about this, talking to my son. He's a younger kid and just getting out of high school and going into college. But what we're talking about is basically helping reefs adapt, and by creating an artificial reef, keeping the water at a constant temperature, possibly, if at all possible, using photovoltaic to chill the water and creating an artificial reef and basically helping it adapt to warmer water slowly versus, you know, the way it's happening now, it's happening rapidly.
You know, what's
it could be possible.
Well, what's interesting, and it's a good point that you bring up, is that we are seeing, we've seen sort of evolution happening right before our very eyes. We are seeing coral reefs and other cephalopods. The coral reefs are not cephalopods, but we specialize in cephalopods in Science Friday, so we follow them closely. They are adapting very quickly. You know, we've seen some species just literally overnight, geologically speaking, you know, or evolutionarily speaking, change. And so what will happen is resistant species will develop, and that's happened. It's a beautiful thing to see now. So there is some hope here.
There's a call on another line on an entirely different subject. We can sort of expect that because we're inviting callers on any number of subject. Steve from St. Louis Heights, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
What's on your mind?
Okay. First of all, I just want to thank Ira. I've been listening to the radio for 70 years, and his is one of the most wonderful programs I ever heard.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you.
My question is this. Science and the news. a lot of people will be more interested in science if it can be connected to the daily news. We just heard about a couple in England who were poisoned by a nerve agent accidentally, and apparently it had to do with being an assassination attempt against a former Russian by the Russian government using a new kind of nerve agent. What's interesting is that that couple, the first couple, they figured out real quick what was going on, and they're been cured. Not, they weren't killed. They got out of the hospital alive, which is great. Ken, would it be possible on your program to tell them, what are nerve agents? How do they work? How could it be that they could be cured instead of killed?
I'm taking notes. And I think it's, you know, we one of the beautiful things, if I can toot my own horn about Science Friday, is that we are a news show. And we can turn on a dime to change subjects. And I was thinking about this myself this morning when I heard the news that you're speaking of. And it would be very interesting to do a show on how these nerve agents work. And as someone who's been a science reporter for 40 years, or longer, I don't want to say, but about 40 years. It is the evolution of nerve agents and whatever stemming out of World War II and, you know, the labs at Columbia University and whatever is quite fascinating. And how they were able to save the first couple, which there was no way to do it, and they were able to find the way of keeping them alive, is an interesting story. I'm glad you suggested it. Thank you.
You know, on that point, we do also have nerve agents shells that are out on the reef, the whole Johnson Atoll time. And so, you know, there are a lot of scientists that are studying that, you know, with the corals hardening the structures and the shells, you know. But what happens if some of that dislodges and it gets into the ocean?
Well, you know, it's the same thing. It's sort of like with asbestos. People discover sometimes it's better to encase the asbestos where it is instead of trying to get it out. It may be better just to leave the nerve agents there and encase them where they are than try to get them out, because if it breaks, you're in trouble.
One thing you alluded to earlier, Ira, is the rapid pace. You're talking about corals in this case, the rapid pace by which species evolve when they're in a kind of isolation.
Right, right, and that's one of the beauties of Hawaii and the islands here.
Exactly,
and that's what we're going to be talking about while we're here. Is that people talk about the Galapagos all the time?
Yeah,
they don't speak enough about, you know, what's going on in the islands here, and so we hope to bring some light to that in our programming this weekend.
There's a fairly hideous adaptation of mice on the Northwest Hawaiian Islands who are now attacking albatross, who have no defense against them. Have you heard about
that?
Yes,
I heard about that.
It's
kind
of awful to contemplate, but it's an example of that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's what it is about island population. It's free to evolve, free from any influence from the outside. So you get some really interesting things. Look at Australia over the centuries.
Yeah.
What kinds of things have evolved there too? So it's interesting stuff.
I just returned from a trip to Paris, and we were going to go out and walk in the forest, and there was some concern because they have Lyme disease and ticks. And it was one of those things where it's like, oh, we are so fortunate here in Hawaii that we don't have a lot of these critters that could really make a nice jaunt in the woods kind of a nightmare.
Well, you know, that's the new thing about air travel. It is so common now, and so many people from all over the world are traveling, that they are bringing the stuff with them from one part of the world. Mm-hmm. Stuff that's never been found in other parts of the world. That's a real danger.
There's really no stopping it, is
no.
there?
No. I mean, they try to, you know. I remember signing a form when I was on the Hawaiian Airlines coming
right,
in
right.
here. You know, they try to do that as much as they can. When in California, they try to check you going over the border, you know, look in your trunk to see what kind of fruits you might be carrying, that sorts of stuff. But it's very, very hard to know what's crawling on you when you're taking it with you when you get on the airline.
It could be something small on your shoes, right?
Yeah. It could be anything. It could be, well, even just some disease that you've been exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And you're now contagious and you don't know it, you know. So you take it from one part of the world to the next.
Yeah, I recall checking the customs things. Have you been on a farm and interacted with livestock in Europe?
Really?
Because
you
want to protect our cattle industry here.
Yeah, if you go to a farm or a ranch, and you want to go visit it many times, there's a big tray of disinfectant you have to step into. You know, if you're familiar with what I'm talking about, just to clean your shoes off before they allow you to come onto the property.
Let me just interject briefly. We're talking to Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday, and we're taking your calls. The numbers are 941-3689 on Oahu. From Neighbor Islands, you can call us at 1-877-941-3689. Just as with Ira's show, any science-related subject is welcome, so do get in touch.
You know, we get calls sometimes, angry calls. Well, they're not really angry. Or I'll get email from some listeners who will say, why are you talking politics on Science Friday? We want to hear science, you know? And people don't realize how connected politics and science are.
Yeah.
Because that's where most of the funding comes from.
Sure.
It comes from Congress or the NSF or people like the NIH. You know, that money comes from what politicians decide themselves where it should go to. So it's very important because you pay for it. It's your tax money, and you should have you should know what's happening to it or not happening to it.
And then you get that effect you described earlier of paying attention to things that affect you personally.
Yes, yes. You know, I remember there are cases with genetic engineering or stem cell research where you'll hear politicians who for their whole careers were against it, and then somebody in their family comes down with, let's say, diabetes,
mm-hmm.
and they've heard instances where maybe stem cell research might cure it. Now suddenly, hey, I'm for that now.
Yeah.
You know? So it's amazing to watch how powerful personal contact is. And I think politicians are understanding that. We have the saying, all of politics is local, right? And so a lot of science politics is local now, too, and people are making it more of a local issue, bringing attention to it that way.
In a way, you might think that the information in and of itself had enough weight to carry the day, but it's the interaction of that information with the human factor.
Well, it's very hard. Something I learned painfully very young in my career is it's very hard to change someone's mind once it's made up. You know what I'm talking about. I see why you're laughing. It is very, very hard to do that. And the way that change happens is when it occurs, it affects you.
Yeah.
Right? I remember in many different forms of research, including global warming or whatever, and people will say, I don't believe it. My mind's not going to be changed. Bam, it hits my family. I now believe it. It affects my money. You know, the price of gasoline is now highest it's been in 4 years.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, wait, gee, maybe I shouldn't have made those giant SUVs anymore. Yeah. So.
I know here in Hawaii we've got, lots of issues with invasive species. We deal with the Koki frog that the Puerto Ricans just love. But we had a totally different viewpoint of this tiny frog invading our backyard.
Right. And yes, you do. And you also have one of the things we're going to talk about is a disease that's affecting your trees here.
Which one? Arapidohia death.
Yes. That's what we're going to talk about. That it's just, I was reading about it. It's just there's nothing to stop this thing.
It's one of our few native trees that are left, too.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have it back home, but the closest thing, I looked at the flower and I said, it looks just like a mimosa tree flower mm-hmm. to me. But, yeah, this is what happens when something gets into the wild that has no natural enemy. You're always looking for something, you know, way to fight it back with a natural enemy. Could be a disease. It could be an insect. And when it doesn't happen, you know, in the States years ago, we had Dutch elm disease, or we've had borer insects that take out, you know, whole bunches of trees attacking New York or any other place, and there's no natural enemy, and you just have to wait. You know, people are chopping down hundreds of thousands of trees to keep it from spreading. It's the only way to stop it in some of these cases.
We had a situation here in Hawaii where the scientists were wrong, and they brought in a natural pest, but they thought it was a natural pest. I think we had rats, and they tried to eradicate them, and they brought in mongoose.
Yeah.
Only they didn't realize that one slept at night. And
history is filled with those kinds of things.
Sure.
You know, look at Australia and rabbits and things.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. You think you're bringing the law of unintended consequences. is very well known. And, you know, scientists are people, and they will make mistakes sometimes.
The process of introducing species hasn't entirely ended. I did an interview about algae overrunning Kaneohe Bay, and I asked how did they get there. I said, well, we brought it out in the 80s. We thought it would be good for the coral. So there, and I've had a couple of examples cited to us where introducing a species work, but it's in the they're very much those cases are very much in the minority.
You know, that's the thing. That's another misunderstood thing about science, is that one of the biggest catalysts in science is failure. Failure is an option in science, and most scientific experiments, most things fail. And it's by eliminating the things that fail you get to what works. You know, it's like being a sculptor. You know, there's just a big block of something waiting to come out, and you chip away at the stuff that fails, that's not supposed to be there. But a lot of people don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that failure is big. They expect black and white answers to things.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We're talking with Science Friday host Ira Flatow this hour. Stay with us. We'll be back right after a short break.
If there's such a thing as Polynesian fusion rock, Tawana is its biggest star, wrote the Honolulu Weekly. HPR invites this original talent to the Atherton Studio on Saturday, July 14th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for Tawana in the Atherton on the 14th. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Each week, Says You, Public Radio's game of words and wit, attempts to present a seamless professional presentation with varying results.
Where are the words?
The words are downstairs.
This is not helpful.
This is an embarrassing moment.
Perhaps you can tell them when these shows will air. And then you won't have to do that.
A teaching moment.
Yes, a teaching moment. And I really don't know when these shows will air.
This evening at 6:30.
And you're back with The Conversation. Our special guest in the studio is Ira Flatow, award-winning science correspondent and radio journalist, host of Science Friday. Call in with your science questions or comments at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 on the Neighbor Islands. And we have one caller on the line. Jay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Jay. What's on your mind?
Well, it's great to have Ira Flatow here. He's my hero, I tell you. Ira, great.
Thank you
for being on HPR.
Thank you very much. I'm glad they have me here.
Here's a question I would have liked to ask you for a long time, and that is, how are we doing? How are we doing on the scientific enterprise in this country? You know, you alluded to the fact that it's hard to train teachers to do science, and I'm sure over your, 80 years in covering science, was it 80?
160, I think.
100, okay. You know, you have been thinking the same thought. How are we doing as against a global enterprise of science that shares between continents and nations and which competes? Do we have enough kids studying science? Do we not have enough scientists? Is our enterprise being sufficiently funded? And if it's not quite, you know, what it should be, what would you recommend that we do, we in Hawaii and we the country?
Well, it's a good question. For many decades and still with a slight edge, the U.S. is the foremost research country in the world. But we have competition now, a lot of competition from countries like China. You know, China has so much money, if we deny visas to Chinese students who want to come over and study here, the Chinese will say, and they are doing this, they'll say, wait, they can't get into MIT. We'll build our own MIT. Mm-hmm. And they have the resources to do that. And if we have a shortage of skilled workers, you know, who's that going to hurt? If we deny those visas, it's going to hurt us. It's not going to hurt them. They'll find jobs someplace else in other parts of the world. So that's the worrisome part, is that even though we still have a research edge, we're going to lose that edge. And once we lose that edge, you know, it'll be hard to see us getting it back, because we have a lot of competing things for that kind of money, and the Chinese can spend it wherever they'd like to. I think they're the single biggest threat to our technology leadership. Not to mention India, which is going to outpopulate China in a few decades.
You know, and that's exactly what you were saying earlier about it being impossible to separate science and politics.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, politics basically sets a course, and then private industry or universities, they sort of follow that course. Politics makes it easier to go that try to smooth that course. And if you upset that course, things could take many years to rebound. You know, if you lose your base of scientists, then it gets harder. You may have to wait for many years to replace them, you know, to get to the level where they're educated enough to go back just to, you know, to keep it where it was before. So if you want to move ahead, you have to invest in the future. And so we need to invest in scientists and science. And I think we also need to teach students who are not going to become scientists what's important about science. I mean, in school, we teach music appreciation. We teach art appreciation.
Yeah.
We don't teach science appreciation. We don't expect everybody to be Yo-Yo Ma when they take music appreciation, or to be Picasso when they take art appreciation. But we teach science, like, well, how many of these kids are going to be scientists? But on the other hand, they're going to be in charge of voting and deciding that political future of where science gets funded. We need to, I think, to be teaching kids more about how to appreciate science. What does science do for you? What's the value of basic research? Who were famous scientists and why were they important? You know, how do you appreciate the benefits science gives you? What are those benefits? We don't expect you to be that scientist, but we expect you to basically learn critical thinking so when science comes under attack, you can say, gee, that doesn't make any sense, you know, and since you're going to be in charge of future political leaders or voters to understand and appreciate science more. I think we need a course of that kind of thing.
You know, Chris and I were talking this morning, and I was sharing that one of my favorite cooking shows was Alton Brown's Good Eats, because he talked about the science of food and what happens when you bake and you add this. And to me, that was just like, wow, that's a whole nother dimension that makes sense. And when you follow a recipe, you understand, oh, okay, well, produces a gas or, you know, whatever the case may be. But it just made cooking more interesting,
right,
because of the chemistry.
Right.
Well, science should never be a tough sell because, you know, as your show has shown many times, as soon as you delve into it even a little bit, you come up with something completely fascinating, right?
Science was never a tough sell,
yeah,
following World War II and when America ascended to its role in the scientific community. It was guaranteed that science, you know, on Capitol Hill, they never discussed whether or not science would be funded. It was just basically how much. It was as guaranteed as Social Security.
Yeah.
Now look at both of them, you know.
Right.
They understood the necessity. Science was an entitlement. You know, who's going to not want to fund science? It's the basis for all our technology. It's where all our food and our, you know, engineering comes from. How could you not do that? Well, now we're faced with, you know, losing maybe Social Security as an entitlement, it's losing science as an entitlement.
Well, look at the, you know, you and I can well remember the enthusiasm of the JFK era,
yes,
space race, right?
Yes, we did.
You know, when John Glenn went up as the most thrilling thing, you know, I can remember from childhood. And everybody was there. Their hearts just were beating along with the, you know, we seven astronauts. I mean, some of that spirit has eroded, don't you think?
Yes, it has, and we don't do big projects anymore. You know, I was speaking of China. A friend of mine, just who's a reporter, has been over there for 40 years, and she was coming back and she was visiting me in New York, and we were talking about did you take the train? She says, you know, in China, no one travels by air. She says. So I said, what do you mean by that? You know, China is so big, they have created a whole system of national railroad. You can go from hundreds of miles, you can jump on a bullet train and go wherever you want for $20. You know, and here you have to get on a plane. You know, it takes you hours and hours. Why doesn't this country have an infrastructure like, you know, like that? It's just a giant country. We have no rail system. Yeah.
Well, there's infrastructures that we used to have, more ironically.
Right? Whatever. What happened to the idea that we are going to rebuild the roads? We're going to have big, big projects that take thought and whatever. We don't hear about that anymore. Yeah.
I am just intrigued because living on an island and growing up on an island, I've just always been fascinated by the ocean. And so I just think there's so much that we don't know about the ocean, and it's right there. You don't have to put a man on the moon. Yes, that's fabulous, and you know, it's captivating. But there's so much undersea that we just don't know about. And I just am a little dismayed that we don't do more.
I'm with you. I'm a Pisces, so I'm a fish. Okay. But, you know, as someone who's been a scuba diver and whatever, and talking to scientists who've been down to the bottom of the ocean, where there's so much to discover there, we probably know less about the oceans, the deep oceans, than anything. And there are such great discoveries from these tube worms to bacteria to... You know, we figure out from studying the bottom of the ocean what's possible to survive in outer space. You know, there are these ironclad archaebacteria and whatever that can they can resist all kinds of threats to their bodies. Maybe they're the same kind of stuff that's living on some of the moons of Jupiter or something like that. So
I was always intrigued because I grew up in Guam, which is right next to the Marianas Trench, which goes down 7 miles deep. And I was just like, oh, there's monsters down there. You know, but there's so much that
there
you just don't know.
There is. All it takes is a national direction. You know, someone has to say this is a high priority for us as explorers, that to explore the deep oceans is as important, let's say, as exploring the moon. Not that they're mutually exclusive, but you have to decide, you know, where are you going to invest your resources?
There's a caller on the line with an ocean-related question. David from Hilo.
And a fellow Pisces. just kind of going back to the topic at the beginning of the show, you're talking about the challenges of ocean temperatures rising. I'm curious about your take on the acidification of our oceans and those challenges.
That's
and
a
what
great challenge.
Might be going on to prevent that. I know consuming less animal products helps in that area.
Well,
and I'd also like to know real quick your take on the latest sunscreen ban that Hawaii just signed off on.
Yeah, I just was reading about that. I'll take the first one. First, when global warming, quote unquote, started to be a thing and talking about it, we used to start talking about climate change. I used to tell my staff, we're not going to talk about climate change. We're going to talk about global warming because that's really the root of all of it, until it became evident that it's not just the warming of the oceans, but it's the acidification of the oceans. The oceans suck in all this carbon dioxide. And as anybody who knows about seltzer water, carbonated water, it gets acidic, you know, when it absorbs carbon dioxide. So it's not just the warming part, it's the climate change part acidifying the oceans. And that's not a healthy thing for the oceans. I used to have an aquarium in my house. I used to be I had a 90-gallon tank with a coral reef in it.
Wow.
So I used to have all these invertebrates in it, and I understood how delicate that water chemistry had to be.
Yeah.
You know, very, and I got very sensitized how difficult that was. So when I used to start hearing about what's happening, the acidification of the ocean, I understood how it doesn't take a whole lot to change what's going on.
You've got, with an aquarium, you've got to be right down to the degree,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, a degree or two, you understand, it will kill something off, you know, or... If you let the algae grow too much, that's a sign that the bad things are going on. So there are these clues that happen. So I agree that ocean acidification is a very very big issue. You know, it's, what was the other part? He asked me another question.
Oh, the sunscreen.
Oh, the sunscreen. Yeah. You know, what's interesting is it's good to see that we're going to have UVA, UVB, and then get rid of some of these ingredients in sunscreen. There are a lot of other chemicals, endocrine disruptors, that are in the environment that we just keep there, that they're there all the time. I remember years and years ago, we did stories on feminization of fish because of these endocrine disruptors.
Hmm.
They catch fish that were changing sex because the ocean, the rivers and streams that they're swimming in, you know, have all these, from birth control pills to every other kind of thing that gets flushed down into the sewage system. I mean, the medicines that you take, only a small fraction of it gets absorbed by your body. You excrete it. So if you have all these endocrines and things that you're taking or all the suntan oil that has the chemical, it's going right into the water. You know, most of it's going to go into the water. So.
I know. I've just always thought that when you're, you know, swimming in Waikiki, I used to get kind of peeved because you'd smell like coconut in the water.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Well,
pervasive.
Well, you know, and we follow all the trends. Summertime, because a lot of people swim in swimming pools, and of course, you know, swimming pools are here. When you start to see the bacteria count in a local swimming pool from kids, everybody swimming in it, you don't want to go into a swimming pool anymore, because I know it's living in that water, even though they're trying to clean it up with, you know, by putting all the chlorine and stuff in there. The fecal counts are just really high. So I'm worried about that also.
Better off in the ocean then.
Yes, I love the ocean.
We've had some recent news. Scientists have basically found that we had a number of deaths of monk seals, and they learned that toxoplasmosis led to their death. And that is, from cat feces.
Yeah.
That it's just lots of colonies, and they wash into the ocean, and it's just a little distressing.
Yeah. You know, the sewage systems can't handle all the sewage that gets, it goes to a sewage treatment plant. And when you have a big rain, what happens in most of the systems across the country,
especially in Hawaii, Ira,
is that you have a mixture of the runoff from the rainwater into the sewage system. And it was very interesting. Years ago, I asked a sewage treatment specialist, because I almost became one myself when I was graduating college. Mm-hmm. I loved, for some reason,
wastewater.
I love wastewater. So I was fascinated with the whole thing of how it works. And he said, you know how we know that happens when it get mixed, the two get mixed? I said, how? He says, we find artificial sweetener in the water.
Oh, God.
I said, what do you mean? He says, he says, artificial sweetener just touched, you taste it, but it goes totally through your body untouched. So when we find artificial sweetener in the ocean, we know that it's been contaminated by sewage runoff.
Interesting.
And that's when we close the beaches.
So. We have a situation here where I think we're the only state that still allows cesspools septic tanks, I think, with new construction.
Yeah.
And I know the EPA is kind of leaning on Hawaii, saying that's got to change, particularly along the coast.
Yes, yes. It just overflows. You know, it all boils down to follow the money. It's very expensive to do these kinds of public works projects. Look what's going on in Flint, Michigan with the water supply, trying to get that changed. You know, it's very expensive stuff.
A situation in Flint has been dragging on for years.
Yeah, yeah, and it will, because it's expensive to do that, and you have to prioritize where you're going to spend your money.
It's not a wealthy community either.
No.
We do have a question from Casey, who emailed, how did Cephalopod Week start on Science Friday?
Oh, what a great question. Oh, goodness. I think we were sitting down one day. We have story meetings every week. And we heard that Shark Week was coming up.
Uh-huh.
You know, Shark Week on cable television. This big, big thing. We said, why should we let Shark Week get all the publicity? We like cephalopods. Let's create.
Amen.
They're more exciting and fun and whatever. And there are more of them, a lot of different cephalopods. Let's do a cephalopod week. And we did that, and it's been snowballing for years. And just finished it.
And the follow-up question is, did you ever expect Cephalopod Week to be as big as it is?
No, it's great. And we have, if you follow our Cephalopod Week hashtag and our stuff on our website, you'll see all the interest in it. And we feature cephalopod scientists, and we just did a trip. We did a trip to watching a cephalopod laboratory. We saw went to the back of the laboratory in the archives. And they had a 112-year-old octopus in a tank.
Wow.
And they're just sitting there. It's been in the same thing for 100 years. And the woman, scientist, was pulling it out, showing us, it was just fascinating stuff. You know, cephalopods.
Something regal about a 112-year-old octopus.
Yeah, squid, octopus, that sort of thing. Nautilus, all kinds of stuff like that. It's fascinating stuff.
There's a caller on the line from Hawaii Island, Gail. Excuse me, talking about Hawaii Island. Gail from Honolulu?
Yes, hello, Ira. I'm calling to ask if you'll be visiting four sites of interest on the Big Island. Number one would be the CO2 data collection site atop Mauna Kea. That's the site that's been collecting CO2 data since the 1950s. Second, whether you'll be visiting any of the telescopes on Mauna Kea. Third, on... also on the Big Island, whether you'll be seeing Halemaumau Crater and Fissure Number 8.
Wow. all places I'd love to go and promise to come back and visit. I promised myself I would get to Volcano Park this year. I'm not going to get there this year because of some natural events that are occurring. I was going to visit the telescopes, but I couldn't fit it into our schedule. I'm only here for a few days, but I'm slowly working on that list because there's such great natural wonders on these islands. So
there's another caller from Hawaii Island, Lauren.
Hello.
Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind?
So I have a question. I was actually up at the summit of Mauna Kea last night, and as I was viewing the sky, sort of around 7:30 coming up to 8 o'clock, there was a slow-moving celestial body. It was passing by Arcturus, sort of heading in a southeast direction, and it had a red tail that was glittering. And it had a red, like, trail, or a golden kind of spread trail, almost half the sky. I haven't been able to find out what it is, searching on Google, searching online. I was wondering if you could help me.
It's what we call a UFO. And I don't mean something alien. I mean, it's an if it's true, it's something unidentified. But I don't know what that could be, you know? It's not the Aurora Borealis, I don't think.
Probably not. How frequent are reports like that, though, of, you know, something seen in the night sky?
You know, all the time. People are always seeing stuff all the time in the night sky. And I have my own little backyard telescope. Now is a really good season to go look at the planets. There's a new planet out, you know, like Jupiter and Mars. Unfortunately, Mars now is so covered in a dust storm that it looks almost like Venus, which you can never see because it's so hazy because of the planet. But there are all kinds of things that you can see. But I don't know what that one is.
It would have been great to have seen it, huh?
Yeah.
I wonder if it was a fireworks display.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be some sort of meteorite that came in, you know.
There's a caller on the line from Maui. Frank?
Yeah. All right, let me get the speakerphone off. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you there?
Yep.
Oh, okay. Well, you were talking about education and... and the forest, and I think just going into Hawaiian history, the natural biosphere, pre-human arrival, had set up a biosphere that was completely symbiotic with trees, not allelopathic, but feeding an understory and root systems that were creating a microbial community in the soil that was, comparable to the American prairie, which was one of the biggest biomasses on the island. And there are several programs going into restoring native forests, native trees, some of which are down to the number of two. And I've been kind of bouncing around. I work in school gardens and that sort of thing. The idea of at early elementary children in school planting seeds, creating seedlings, that they then nourish through their education so that by the time we're out of high school, we've got saplings with high school kids doing field trips up and restoring the forest canopy around the rims and helping with water catchment, carbon sequestration, and restoring microbial integrity, which is one of the biggest things that was lost here. Because photosynthesis goes all the way down to the roots, and the microbes are breaking minerals down to feed the tree to make the thing. So restoring food forests, basically, which is, you know, the kind of the cultures that came in here from Japan and China, Philippines and Asia, non-European cultures had food forests. So you had your orchard, you had your pasture, you had your crops and grains, and just sort of using the islands as kind of a petri dish to find out what it takes to house, feed, clothe people within their own biosphere so that we're growing what we need.
You know, it's a great topic. One of the things we like to talk about on Science Friday is the microbiome. And we usually talk about the microbiome in our bodies, where there are trillions of, you know, living things that are not ours that live there. But there is also, as a caller is pointing out, there's a huge microbiome in the soil. And it is, you know, it is something that so needs to be studied, is being studied slowly, but is like the bottoms of the oceans. We hardly know anything about what's going on in the soil. the plants, the trees, they talk to each other through the soil. They share information. The largest living thing on Earth is a fungus that I think lives in the Pacific Northwest that's a couple of miles big. It's like a giant mushroom underground. It's a fungus underground. It's the biggest single living thing on the planet, and we don't know a whole lot about how it grows and what's going on there. So you're right. Studying the microbiome, studying the natural ecology of the soil is a wonderful thing.
Well, Ira, the caller used a phrase that I'm not familiar with, restoring microbial integrity.
Well, that's the microbiome in the soil.
Okay.
There are studies now that show that when you plow up the soil, you have this microbiome, you have all this stuff that lives, you know, in the soil. When you plow it up, you totally destroy the microbiome that's been there for decades, hundreds mm-hmm. of years. It could take many years to restore that. And we don't know the exact role it plays in things that grow. Some studies have shown that, okay, if you compare a crop that's planted after you till the soil with a plow versus the old way where they took a seed and stuck it in the ground with a rod,
yeah,
the seed has a much higher productive rate than the seed that's planted by tilling up the ground, because with the rod, really, you haven't upset the microbiome that's been living in the soil all these years. So it's just a fascinating topic.
For much of its modern history, Hawaii was devoted essentially to two crops, sugar and pineapple.
Right.
And I gather that messed up the microbiome pretty well.
Well, whenever you have a monoculture,
yeah,
you know, nature loves biodiversity. And it could be biodiversity of people, could be biodiversity of crops, it could be biodiversity of animals. And when you upset the biodiversity and create a monoculture, you have upset nature, because nature doesn't like monocultures. So,
what does it take to restore a microbiome?
You have to. I don't know how you could physically restore the microbiome. The best way in the soil is just to leave it alone. It will come back itself if you just leave it undisturbed or minimally disturb it. He was also talking about, the caller was talking about carbon sequestration. The soil will soak up a lot of carbon from the air if you let it do that. And if it's, you can do it in a few ways. You let the soil do it naturally, or what some farmers, progressive farmers, are discovering, that they can plant crops over the wintertime when crops, you know, the soil is usually bare. You see farms with nothing on them. They plant crops that will soak up the CO2 and sequester some of that CO2. Back into the soil.
You talk about pollution. I remember on a trip to China, it was so polluted that I just wanted to cry. I felt so sad for the whole world.
Yeah. I remember I was there a few years ago in China, and it was amazing. As a child of the 60s, who, before I started covering science when I was in college, I covered anti-war riots and demonstrations, been through a few gassings and things like that,
right.
Worn a few, you know, gas masks. And so I was in China. I was in a hotel in China, and they had two gas masks in the closet, beautiful red velvet cases they were in, you know, said gas. I thought, geez, is there a riot going to break out? Do I need a gas mask? No, it was for the weather, you know. It was for the pollution that was there. And, the limit of particulates in the U.S. is about 35 parts per million. One day in China, it was 600 when I was there. I was like, you know. It was amazing.
Yeah, I know they were trying to plant rose bushes, I think, to clean up the air and prevent people from driving. If you had a even numbered license plate, you can only drive on certain days. I mean, they were trying everything, but it was just so sad.
Yeah, well, they have the resources to take action. They are the fastest growing renewable energy country in the world. You know, they're investing more in solar and wind than anybody. Terms of, you know, they have a long way to go because they still have a lot of coal plants, but they have decided that they're going to try to, you know, get rid of that pollution.
Has this planet got a fighting chance, Ira?
I think so. You know, the solace I take is I go back and I read editorials from the newspapers 100 years ago, and they're saying the end of the planet is doomed also. So, I mean, if there's any bit of hope you can get about it, that people talk about it. But we are facing stuff now that we've never faced before. I think
I'm not sure how comforting that is.
It is. You know, climate change really is a threat. and is a threat to every form of life and every different kind of way you can think of. So, but we have to speak out about it. We have to talk about it. We have to push back and let people know and be proactive in bringing the topics up to talk about. And we have to question people, why aren't you talking about it now? So it's a kind of thing that's not going to go away overnight.
And we have to hope that the people who control the purse strings get affected in a very personal way, so they take action.
They hear you. My listeners say, what do I do about this? I say, you know how to vote? That's what you do.
All politics is local,
it
as
is.
You pointed
it's
out earlier.
It's all local, yeah.
And so that's what you would say to anyone.
Get involved with the young people. They know it's their future. They're now getting, these teenagers are now showing us a kind of energy we've never seen since we were doing it in the 60s, and I was their age. And so that really makes me optimistic about this.
Good, because we want to end on an optimistic
note. Yes, yes.
Ira, thanks very much for being with us. This has been great. It's really fascinating.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To talk with you.
So thanks to Ira, and we thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. If your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the TalkBack line. Leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217.
You also can send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz, and I'm told that there may be a few more tickets left for Ira's show, so don't delay. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.